And all this week, we've been talking about obesity in our series called America on the Scale. Yesterday, we talked to Dr. Francis Collins, head of the National Institutes of Health, about finding solutions on a national level. And in our conversation, we talked about why the very simple solution of diet and exercise isn't really all that simple.
We have less opportunities for exercise. Walking is much less likely to happen. Exercising in a playground is not available to many kids in the inner city who sit in front of screens all day. And you have this constant barrage of advertising, including to children, who then go to mom and dad and say, I've got to have that sugary cereal because it had such a compelling advertisement on the television.
Well, what about that sugary cereal and all of the foods we eat every day? What is the food industry's role in obesity? Michael Moss is an investigative reporter and author of the book Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. He joins us. Michael, welcome to Here and Now.
Nice to be with you.
Well, let's start with that subtitle, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Is it possible to prove or quantify the level of responsibility that the food industry holds in this obesity epidemic in America?
I was really struck by how many people inside the industry itself who hold their industry totally accountable, totally culpable for this surge in obesity that we've had for the last 30 years now. Clearly, there are other contributing factors. Clearly, there are things like exercise and personal responsibility. But they, being insiders, came to believe that all of the effort they put into making their products so irresistible, so tasty, so perfectly engineered to get us to not just like them, but to want more and more of them, laid that responsibility directly at their feet.
What do you mean perfectly engineered? Give me an example of that. What did they do?
So they would hire people like Howard Moskowitz, trained in high math at Queens College and then experimental psychology at Harvard. Howard was one of the people responsible for some of the biggest icons in the grocery store. And for example, he walked me through his recent creation of a new soda flavor for Dr. Pepper, in which he started with no less than 59 different variations of sweetness, each one just slightly different than the next, subjected those to 3,000 consumer taste tests around the country, did his high math regression analysis thing, put the data in the computer, and out comes these bell-shaped curved where the perfect amount of sweetness, not too little, not too much, is at the very top of the curve. And it was Howard who coined the expression the bliss point to capture that perfect amount of sweetness that would send us over the moon, their products flying off the shelf. But, you know, it's not that they engineer bliss points for sweetness in things like soda and ice cream and cookies, things we know and expect to be sweet. The food companies have marched around the grocery store adding sweetness, engineering bliss points to products that didn't used to be sweet anymore. So now bread has added sugar and a bliss point for sweetness. Yogurt can be as sweet as ice cream in some brands. And pasta sauce, my gosh, there are some brands with the equivalent of a couple of Oreo cookies worth of sugar in a tiny half cup serving. And what this does, nutritionists say, is create this expectation in us that everything should be sweet. And this is especially difficult for kids who are hardwired for the sweet taste. So when you drag their little butts over to the produce aisle, right, and try to get them to eat some of that stuff we all should be eating more of, Brussels sprouts and broccoli, which have some of the other basic tastes like sour and bitter and what have you, you get a rebellion on your hands.
But I can see why the sugar industry would want to do that. I can see why high fructose corn syrup would want to do that, because they are going to sell more of their product to these food makers. Why do the food makers have an interest in making everything sweet?
You know, it's very simple, and it's why I don't view this industry as this evil empire that intentionally set out to make us obese or otherwise ill. I mean, these are companies doing what all companies want to do, sell as much product as possible to make as much money as possible. And the way they do it is maximize the allure of their products. And there's really nothing like sugar, like sweetness, to do that. We almost all love sugar, and it starts at birth. And making products sweet sends that signal to the reward center of the brain, which sends back that signal of pleasure that says, wow, Michael, love that. Let's eat more.
So is there any movement within to stop that? The way you describe this, it sounds like you could compare it to the tobacco industry and sort of denying that their products were causing any trouble years and years ago.
Well, one of the fascinating things I came across in my research was that it was none other than Philip Morris, who for years and years was the largest food manufacturer in North America through its acquisition of General Foods and then Kraft. It was none other than the tobacco fish managers at Philip Morris who turned to their food managers, and this is 1999, 2000, and warned them way back then that they were going to face as much trouble over salt, sugar, fat, obesity as they were then over tobacco and smoking and health problems. Now we're starting to see that come home for the food companies. Earlier this year, almost all of them stood before investors, reported dismal earnings, and the most forthright among the heads of the food companies attributed that decline to consumers caring more and more about what they put in their bodies, wanting to eat healthier, and acting on those decisions by changing their purchasing habits, which is really hitting the food giants hard.
We're speaking with Michael Moss, who's an investigative reporter and author of the book Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Michael, what about advertising? When you look up at a TV commercial these days, you're almost guaranteed to see some kind of junk food up there. I do not see a lot of ads for salads and organic, whole grains and things like that.
Right. I mean, all of the advertising goes to the 90% of the grocery store that concerns itself with processed food. There's almost no advertising in the produce section. I was really struck by the time I spent with the former president of Coca-Cola, Jeffrey Dunn. For 20 years, he was one of their fiercest warriors at the company. He walked me through their creation of the supersize me phenomenon, the warlike language that they used in their competition with Pepsi, and their incredible cunning targeting of kids at corner stores, knowing that when kids walk into those stores with a little bit of their own spending money for the first time and they make a purchase decision, they will become brand loyal. Clearly, there are some other things going on here, and there are experts who say there was a day in the 1980s when suddenly it became socially acceptable to eat anything, anywhere, anytime. That's when you saw parents stop telling their kids not to snack between meals. Snacking became the fourth American meal, and that played right into the hands of the food companies. So on one hand, you can look at them as sort of driving our culture of eating now that's dominated by excessive, empty, bad-for-you calories. On the other hand, though, they have been in part responding to and capitalizing on changes that's been happening in society, including those that caused us to no longer avoid snacking.
But on their own terms.
On their own terms. That's when they went after and invented these products like the Go-Gurt, sort of the handheld, cloyingly sweet yogurt that you could eat with one hand while doing something else at the last time, like holding a joystick in your hand. And it was sort of
because who has time for a yogurt anymore, really?
or who knows what a spoon is in a bowl or that sort of thing. And that sort of drove our shift toward what experts called mindless eating, not paying attention to what we're doing. And then sort of the thinking part of your brain absolutely has no chance over the primitive part of your brain, which is going salt, sugar, fat, more.
But for the things that the industry does not want to do on its own, do regulators have any power? Because I think back to what happened in New York City when Mayor Bloomberg tried to get people to drink less of very sugary drinks, and it didn't work.
I was really struck by how in many cases the companies are more powerful than the regulators who are out there supposedly to monitor them for our behalf. I think the change is going to come from, getting kids excited about food in schools, educating school gardens, getting a kid to fall in love with a radish is going to be a huge thing going down the road. Nudging consumers into buying healthier foods, including lots more produce in the produce section, that's going to cause – it already is. It's going to cause these food giants to change, and it's also causing this – big wave of upstart companies trying to reinvent processed foods to make them convenient, low-cost, tasty, but also good for you. And interestingly, some of the former insiders from the food giants are actually switching sides to help these young, innovative companies scale up and succeed. I think that's incredibly exciting, and that's where the big change is going to come.
Michael Moss, an investigative reporter and author of the book Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Michael Moss, fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
Nice talking to you.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts at hereandnow.org. Tomorrow, as we wrap up our series, we'll look at how the stigma of obesity can affect someone's ability to get a job and even their mental health.
There tends to be this societal perception that maybe stigma will somehow motivate people to lose weight. But when we look at the research on this issue, we see exactly the opposite is true, that in fact, experiences of weight discrimination or stigma is actually reinforcing obesity.
That's tomorrow on Here and Now.